Acts 9, we've been looking at Acts chapter 9, verses 26 through 29. We've finished up most of that. But let's go back and sort of get that section before us, because that's where a new paragraph begins in the ASV. I'll read through 26, probably down through verse 29. And then that'll, like I say, most of that'll be old material, so we won't cover it again. And then we'll pick up with 30 and 31 in just a bit, and that'll be absolutely new. 26 says, "And when he, that was Saul, was come to Jerusalem, he essayed to join himself to the disciples. And they were all afraid of him, not believing that he was a disciple. But Barnabas took him and brought him to the apostles and declared unto them how he had seen the Lord in the way, and that he had spoken to him, and how at Damascus he had preached boldly in the name of Jesus. And he was with them going in and out at Jerusalem. Preaching boldly in the name of the Lord, he spake and disputed against the Grecian Jews, but they were seeking to kill him." All right, we talked before about the fact that I think, and can't prove this for sure, but probably Luke and Stephen were members of the same synagogue, and you likely have Stephen defecting from the synagogue. He leaves that synagogue in Acts chapter 6. He goes back to talk to his friends. They don't receive that very well. Saul's also a member of that synagogue, and he certainly doesn't receive that very well, and that probably explains why in Acts chapter 8 and verse 1, he's consenting to see Stephen's death. Stephen has opposed the people in the synagogue, one of whom was Paul. Perhaps he'd been former friends. Saul is very upset about that. Now you have Saul going back to these Grecian Jews, very likely that same synagogue, and obviously they're not going to be very happy with him as well. But Saul is now preaching, and how is he preaching? He's preaching boldly. Well, that's probably not going to be met very well if you're on the opposing side, and that's certainly true here. When you look at the ASV or King James translation, you see the word seeking in the American Standard Translation went about in the King James. That's found only three times. And again, they were really trying to do him in. So that kind of sums up where we wanted to hit to as far as today, verses 30 and 31. "And when the brethren knew it, they understood that these Jews were seeking to kill Paul. They brought him down to Caesarea and sent him forth to Tarsus. So the church throughout all Judea and Galilee and Samaria had peace, being edified, and walking in the fear of the Lord and in the comfort of the Holy Spirit was multiplied." This is going to take us back to a point that I made a week or two ago. Remember over there in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 39, Jesus said, if you're struck on this cheek, do what? Turn the other. Now, we have some people in our area who are strongly pacifist, and there's certainly nothing wrong with that. But you would find that there are some people who have the idea that whatever somebody wants to do to you, you just take it. If they want to kill you, if they want to stab you, if they want to assault you, then you just go ahead and say, well, that's fine, Matthew chapter 5 and verse 39, I'm not going to resist. Is that what you find with Saul? He didn't just stay in town and let these people kill him. And did the brethren? Now, you could argue that they sinned. They should have just let them wail on him or kill him or do whatever they wanted to do, but that's not the behavior that you find here. What do? They take him and they say, we're going to first go to what area? We're going to head you down to Caesarea. Caesarea was about 75 miles away. I think probably the most likely way to get down there would have been travel by road, and they may have ridden something, may have walked, but it was a pretty good distance. Now, putting 75 miles between you and somebody else is probably going to be a reasonable distance if you're going to try to calm things down a little bit. Even by car, you're probably going to have to travel at least an hour to get that far. So they don't let the angry people do whatever they want to do to Saul. The word brought is significant here. That could mean a couple of things. It could mean that they actually took him down there personally, or it could mean that they simply gave him the supplies. There are a couple of ways to help people. We have that happen today. We might actually pick somebody up and say, we're going to accompany you down to this particular place because you have this need, maybe offer some protection. Or it could be that we simply say, you need some money, you need some bus money, you need some train money, you need plane fare. We will go ahead and provide you the resources that you need. Here's some food, pack them some food. And maybe it was both. But anyway, they do ensure that Paul is able to get down there. Now, why go down to Caesarea? Anybody know? Obviously, it gets them out of the immediate vicinity of Jerusalem, 75 miles away or thereabouts. Why else, though? What was in Caesarea?
Close to his home.
Well, he's getting close to his home.
Spiritual brethren?
Well, possibly that, too.
Well, it's right on the water.
Is yeah.
Food, with fish and things.
Well, there's that, but he's also going to head where, ultimately? He's going to head back to Tarsus. See that in the text?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you're going to get from Caesarea
300 miles away to Tarsus, how do you think you're going to go?
By boat.
You're probably going to go by boat. And if Caesarea has a seaport, well, that's an obvious place to pick up a boat. So it seems to me that that probably was where they wanted to get him to so that he would be able to make that transportation by water. Now, what do we know about Tarsus? Saul's life. All right, that was Saul's hometown. Maybe he's thinking he's going to go back and get some additional resources there, find some friends and family, maybe go back and do some teaching. But you have to read between the lines a little bit. Saul's left the Hebrew faith, and the places where he's gone, how's that been working out for him? Not so swell. You go back to Tarsus. You go back to your family. We talked before about the fact that maybe they had sacrificed some to give him a great education. Suppose that you are, and this could go a couple of different ways, but suppose that you have parents which are very conservative. Conservative religiously, conservative politically, conservative across the board. And they scrape and they work and maybe pick up a second job to send their child to school, and the child goes to school, gets a great education, gets a wonderful degree, and the child becomes a rabid liberal. How do you think mom and dad are going to feel?
Not
so happy. And it can work in reverse. You can have a very liberal home, and then they send their child off to a school, and the child decides, I'm going to take a strong conservative streak. So it can cut both ways. Looking at how that may have played out in Saul's home, can you imagine? Here, we've raised him as a Jew, given him this great education, done all these things for him, and now he comes back, and what's he done for us? He's not just become a Christian. What's he doing? He's running around the countryside, you know, teaching against the gospel. Can you imagine how his parents must have felt? That's a point that I think is not given a lot of attention when you study Saul's life. But if he's going back to Tarsus, and he's hoping for a positive reception from mom and dad, if they're still alive, and other friends and family members, I doubt that he got such a good reception. They probably didn't throw out the welcome mat for him. Anything you want to add or ask before I make a couple more points? Carol? Very likely. I think he took every opportunity he could, and certainly friends and family members should have been dear to his heart. So I don't think it would have been a hard sell getting him back to Tarsus. He seems to have been more than willing to do that, but we wonder about the reception he got. All right. Once again, if you're putting 75 miles between you and somebody else, it's probably going to temper the persecution a little bit when you think about first century transportation methods. But now, what have we said? From Caesarea to Tarsus, it's about how many more miles? 300. So 300 plus 75, you're now about how many miles away from Jerusalem?
75.
Well, you're about 400 miles if you round it up. So that's a pretty good distance. And even beyond that, I think when he gets back to Tarsus, that's really going to help start launch his preaching career. When you look at that word which is translated sent, that's in the first part of verse 30. They bring him down to Caesarea and sent him. Some sources would suggest that that has the idea of sending out a representative with a commission. So these brethren apparently realized that Saul was going to be someone that God could use in a mighty way, and they were exactly right. I want to give you kind of a quick summary of Saul. We've talked about this a little bit, but to sort of put things in perspective, let me see if I can lay this out reasonably well. We know back in Acts chapter 9, verses 1 through 2, he's in Jerusalem. This is prior to his conversion, and where's he heading? He's heading to the city of Damascus to do what? To persecute Christians. All right, he's converted. Acts chapter 9, verses 3 through 22. And after he's converted, that happens in the city of Damascus, then he begins to do some preaching and teaching in the city of Damascus. Then he leaves Damascus, from what we can tell, and he heads where for 3 years? He goes over to Arabia. And we pick that up from the book of Galatians, Galatians chapter 1, verses 17 through 18. So he has that 3-year stint in Arabia. Then he comes back to Damascus, the place where he was converted, and he begins doing some preaching and teaching there for a little while. That's in Acts chapter 9, 23 to 25, what we've looked at. You also see a reference to that in Galatians 1, 17. And then, also where we've been, he leaves the city of Damascus, and then he goes back where? He goes back to the city of Jerusalem. And then now we have him headed where? He's going over to the city of Caesarea to get on that ship to go to Tarsus. And again, that's going to launch his preaching career. Luke concludes this section with the information in verse 31. And he says, the church. If you have the King James translation, you're going to have the word churches. That is a manuscript variation. And I think the ASV with the manuscript evidence that we have is probably singular. But again, you do find some versions that will have the word church. And you not only have the church or the churches in a specific area mentioned, but you also have them specifically identified. The church or the churches were in, number one, Judea. And number two, it would be Galilee. And then in number three, it is Samaria. Well, haven't we read about those three places before in the book of Acts? How about Acts chapter 1 and verse 8? Jesus said the gospel needs to go where? It needs to go into, well, all the world. But if we back up a little bit, it needs to go first into, well, the area of Judea, which would have included Jerusalem. And then we've got Samaria or Galilee and Samaria, depending on which way you want to put them. But Jesus said, specifically, all the world ultimately, but these three areas, and that's exactly what we find here, and that's very significant. When we think about the word church, as far as how it's used in the New Testament, do we sometimes have the word church being used to describe a local body of people? Yes. Can you think of an example of that? The church at where? The church at?
Ephesus.
All right, the church at Ephesus. The church at? Corinth, 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 2, the church at Thessalonica, Philippi, so you do have a local congregation. What about the idea of churches in a local community or maybe a local area? In our country, the churches in a particular state. Do we have a usage of that?
Rome.
Well, there would be one, but how about our text?
Rome.
How about Acts chapter 9 and verse 31? So the church or the churches where? Throughout Judea, the Judean churches, the churches in Galilee, the churches in Samaria, and so forth. And then, if we've got the word church being used to describe a local body, and we've got the word church being used to describe the churches in a specific area, then the next one would be what? We've got the church in what sense? The church in the... Okay, well, or even the universal sense. That would be the ultimate application of that. And can you think of a passage? Maybe not the exact reference, but can you think of a text where it would describe the church in its universal sense?
The churches of Christ salute you.
All right, that would be a good one. Romans 16 and verse 16. I didn't have that one down, but that would be good. I'm going to add that. I tell you, sometimes you guys come up with better ideas than mine. I'm not ashamed to put it in my notes. All right, what else?
Talking about Christ's body, the church.
All right. That would certainly be one, Ephesians 1, 22 and 23. Jesus is the Savior of the body, or the church, Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 27. So the church, describing the same people, but sometimes you have a smaller segment of the church, sometimes it is a church as a whole. Anything that you might want to ask before you make some other points? Tim?
I think the word church is plural there is good, because it said they had rest, the churches had rest throughout all Judea, Galilee, Samaria. So it wouldn't be just one congregation. It would be several congregations spread out through that area.
Yeah. Yeah. The church, just the word church, ecclesia, just describes an assembly. I picked up something a few days ago that if I knew, I'd forgotten. I don't think I'd ever seen this before. But there is a source, not a source which is looking at a particular passage, but a source which describes biblical words. It said that the word church or ecclesia was sometimes used to describe an army. I thought that was interesting because, again, you have an assembly, you have a group of people. Well, what's an army? It's an assembly, it's a group of people. They are called out for a particular reason. They're going to do some training or they're going to do some fighting or so forth. I don't think that you want to take that and say that the church, as we know it, is an army. I think that's probably going way too far, but just as far as how the word is used. Over in Acts chapter 19, it describes an assembly. That's one of the passages there. Also in Acts 19, you have another passage which describes pretty much a mob, but the mob, the group, the assembly, the called out came together and so forth. Let's take a look at something else. As we look at Acts 9, 30 and 31, we have one of the, this is the third, of seven progress reports in the book of Acts. Sometimes, I don't know if they do this now, if you have kids in school, maybe you can tell me, do they still send out progress reports for kids in school?
Well, there's an app that you can watch every single day what they do.
Okay, So you can now get a daily progress report. Things have been updated a little bit. But the old days, you used to get a progress report, maybe once a quarter. Or, yeah, Jen's kind of nodding her head like, yeah. Oh, okay, so you can get a progress report. Luke does the same thing in the book of Acts. He gives seven progress reports. And this is, as far as this progress report, a little unusual. He mentions congregations where? That would surprise you. Congregations in? Well, would that, okay. Samaria might surprise you a little bit. But I think the one that surprises me the most is Galilee. The gospel had made it at this time all the way up into Galilee. Now, who was from Galilee? Do you remember? All right, we know Jesus was. He was the Galilean. Mark chapter 1 and verse 9. Jesus had done a considerable amount of preaching and teaching in Galilee. He'd also performed a number of miracles in Galilee. But this is the only time in the book of Acts that you read about congregations in the area of Galilee. Now, who established them? I don't know. How many were there? How strong were they? I don't know. But maybe Jesus, as he was doing his preaching and teaching, perhaps even being from that area, it was kind of, okay, I'm planting the seeds, I'm laying the groundwork, because I know that there are going to be people up here at a later time who are willing to be obedient to me. There's, I think, an implied lesson in there. Sometimes you go out and you see things maybe in the middle of nowhere, and you think, well, how did that end up out here? What kind of time would that describe in your life? What have you seen? Were you thinking that? And you say, wow, how did that end up here? And it just seems so out of place.
You mean like a tornado?
Oh, all right. You see a tornado rip through a particular area and you think, you know, that's unusual. Anything else?
When we were in Canada, like Calgary, you would drive for miles with seeing nothing. Then all of a sudden there's a church in the middle of the field. Why?
Yeah.
There's no homes.
You can find that even sometimes here in the Midwest. Maxine, anything? You have driven to Alaska, right? Anything on the drive where you saw something that was kind of out in the middle of nowhere and you thought?
Not so much churches. But, you know, there were churches in towns, in the cities where we went. But not so much out in the country, no.
Anything else you saw kind of out in the middle of nowhere? Any kind of structure?
No, not really.
Okay. Well, you can find that sometimes. And I can't help but wonder if people thought, well, there's a congregation in Galilee? I mean, I would have thought maybe Samaria, you know, they're kind of their own little brand down there, but certainly in Jerusalem, but all the way up here as well. Ray?
Strange thing is you can see there's lots of them out there, but the one that really sticks in my mind is out on US 40 down the other side of Oklahoma City. There's a bunch of Cadillacs that are buried, first down in the ground. Now, for years, I would go by there and see them. Now they have, it's a wide highway there. They actually have sidewalks from one lane to the other lane to where people can go out and see those Cadillacs, and that's all fenced off open with a big walkway out there too.
Yeah, some of the western states do have those kinds of things. Maybe it's a little diner. I mean, you're driving along and there's nothing out there and all of a sudden a diner with a single gas pump. They probably upgraded that now. They've got maybe three gas pumps. But still, there are those things that just kind of stick out. They're almost an anomaly. Okay, let's go back and talk about a couple of the things here. The congregations that we've been discussing, were they doing well or not so swell? They're doing great. What was one of the obvious reasons why they were doing so wonderfully? All right. Saul had quit his persecution. I mean, he was the guy that was really stirring things up. And now he's gone from I'm opposing you to now I'm supporting you. I want to help you guys. So he talks about the peace that these congregations had. A big contributing factor of that to that had to certainly be Saul. You also find that God's people were being edified. Not exactly sure what all that means. I think there are a couple of leading possibilities. Number one, it might be that this is a reference to unity. When you find that you're in a group, and this can sometimes be in a congregation as far as the general life of a congregation, or maybe you've got this. Anybody ever been in a Bible class with somebody where there is not just some discussion, but it just seems like there's a knockdown drag out with people, and maybe not just once or twice, it just seems like it is an ongoing occurrence? Anybody ever been in some of those classes? Maybe nobody wants to admit it, but a couple heads are nodding. But those are generally not fun. I mean, some healthy discussion, maybe some debate is good at times, but if you feel like, you know, it's just always kind of the push and pull and there's just constant friction, there are a few people that thrive on that kind of thing, but I think most people probably don't. And if you're in a congregation where it seems like it's a war zone, you know, people are always kind of getting shot, not literally, but figuratively speaking, it's not going to be much fun. Congregations, you know, in town, you know, fighting with one another, those kinds of things. Unity is generally attractive to people. A lack of unity, that kind of friction is usually not too pleasant. You, I think, can also find when you look at the idea here as far as the peace, you look at the edification, that's also got to be tied in with studying God's Word. If you're studying Scripture, you're applying it, you should come out to the same conclusions. And not everybody believes that, but we do apply that teaching to some other areas in life, don't we? I've sometimes used traffic to illustrate that. You study the book, red means red, that's what the book says. Well, then what's red mean? Red's got to mean red, and that means stop, and so forth. Green means go, and those kinds of things. So when kids go through school, they study information, we can come to the same conclusions. It's also possible, as we look at this peace and edification, that it describes growth. It could be spiritual growth. It could be numerical growth. It could be both. But it is, once again, a picture that things are going very, very well. Then there's one other possibility. Perhaps this would be related with the growth. If things are going this well, the congregations are strong, everything is going great, very likely what else is taking place internally in some of these congregations? They've now become sufficient to the point where they can develop what kind of people? We can now have elders, and we can now have deacons, and maybe they even had some preachers that were also working. So you do find some maturity and great growth as far as these congregations. This also, I think, lends itself to a couple of the other points. When things are going very, very well, it could be in the home, it could be in church, could be in the workplace, but when things are going great, what can be a temptation for people? They can become
complacent.
There is my word, complacent. Why is that?
It's always going to be this way.
Yeah, let's back up a little bit. What's the word complacent mean? Let's define our word.
Staying in one place.
All right, you know, we're okay and we're content to stay here and not really move forward. Everything's always going to be great, so let's just let things rest and we don't have to do very much. What's the problem with that?
Growth.
All right, there's going to be a lack of growth. And not only might there be a lack of growth, can you start going backwards? Complacency can lead to what? Well, okay, there is that. That's a biggie. All right, apathy, sloppiness, those kinds of things, because you're not trying to stay on your toes. But these congregations, even though things are going great, would you say that they became complacent? Here, at this point, they're doing well. But you do find a little bit later that they, and maybe it was because of the complacency, they did get complacent. Complacency is a very dangerous place to be. So always trying to at least maintain. We may not be able to go forward for one reason or another, but at least trying to stay on our toes and maintain what we have, what we're doing, and ideally press forward when we can. Ray?
I think that the word complacent there and things means that you still have, they're not complacent in this group. And they have that fellowship one with another. They need that Christian fellowship with each other. Later on, when they become complacent, they're on their own. They don't feel they have to have that closeness, and therefore they become lax.
Yeah, people, we've already arrived, we've got our ticket punched, those kinds of things, and they feel like they're good, so why continue to do very much? But that's not what we find in Scripture. Tim, and then we'll take Stan's hand, and then Teresa.
The Lord said that he would rather have us cold than be lukewarm. And that term lukewarm is another word for complacent.
Sure, and that's absolutely right. He made it very clear that that's absolutely disgusting to God. So, good thought.
That's exactly the point I was making.
All right, well, two for one. Trace?
Well, I think the Old Testament is loaded with the children of Israel being faithful, unfaithful, faithful. People make the same mistakes over and over. You can look at world history or biblical history.
Yeah. Well, you can idle a vehicle, but when you put your life into idle mode, it's not going to go well, whether it's in the physical realm or whether it's in the spiritual realm. That it? Okay, let's point out something else. As long as times are good, work, home, church, are a lot of people on board? Sure. You have a local congregation which seems to be thriving and doing well, and people say, I want to be part of that. But what happens when difficult times set in? Uh-huh.
Goodbye.
Yeah. What happens in the home? People get married. I love you. You love me. We're happy. The money is good. The health is good. Everything is great. And then you hit a time where things are not so great. A lot of people say what?
Bye.
Yeah, bye. The better, the worse. I've had the better. Now we've hit the worse. I'm done. I'm going to find somebody else who can bring back the good times. What about in the job? You get the job and you think this is the perfect job. I'm having so much fun and the money's good and the health insurance is good. The other benefits are good. I like the people. 6 months into it, a year into it, 5 years into it, what happens? No longer fun. What am I going to do? Hit the door. Now, that may or may not be a problem in the secular world. I do know, and this is perhaps not something that we see with the newest generations, but you do find with older generations, and I realize that there were some differences in the work world, but people would take a job and they would stay with it for 10, 20, 30, 40, sometimes 50 years. They didn't necessarily like the job. I mean, maybe 5 years into it, they're thinking, when can I retire? 25 more years, that doesn't sound very fun to me. And yet they got up and they stuck with it. And that speaks very well of those previous generations. But there's been a shift in thinking, and not just in the secular work world. Betty, I think that was your hand.
In the secular work world, even in the church, if you're one willing to give up, and because the times are bad, or, you know, it just comes to the point you don't want to deal with that particular situation anymore, and you leave, and you get into another relationship or whatever, be it job, be it home, be it another church, eventually it's going to do the same thing.
Sure.
You're going to be doing the same thing unless you have a mind change, because you're going to constantly be doing that if that's the way you handle life.
Yeah. And there are people. They're mate hoppers or job hoppers or church hoppers. You can be a hopper. And there are a lot of people that have adopted that philosophy. Think about what Jesus taught in one of his parables. You remember the parable of the sower? He said when, what's that T word? And then we've got a P word which follows. When there is no tribulation or
persecution.
Well, we got one out of the two. That's good. When tribulation or persecution arises, what happens? That seed dies. People don't stick with it. That's exactly right. Do you suspect that there were some people who were at least tempted, and maybe when Saul was doing all of his nasty persecution, they said, it's not for me? Become a Christian. I like the people. I like the fellowship. I like the worship. I like the fact that we can do away with the Old Testament system. Everything is great. But when that persecution came from Saul, I'm out of here. But apparently there were still some Christians in these three areas who stuck with it. During the bad times, now they've got peace, but during the bad times, they hung with it. Now they're with the good times, and they're still with it. The implied lesson for us is what? You stick with it when times are good, times are bad. And to go back to Betty's point for just a second, and then we'll take your hand again. If you are with a local congregation long enough, are you going to see some good times? Someone might say not there. I think generally, are you going to see some good times?
Yes.
Yes. If you're with a local congregation long enough, are you probably going to see some bad times, some rough times? Yes. And we need to, I think, have Christians understand that you need to ride those times out. Enjoy the high times, and when the times are bad, and there likely will be some, ride those times out. Do your best to work through them. Do your best to be helpful as far as overcoming those things, and that's going to even out. But don't expect it all to be a bed of roses, because whatever you're doing in local congregation, it's not going to be that way.
Churches in those areas where they weren't having the persecution from Saul.
That's possible. We don't know exactly where they went to. I mean, you've got some information about Philip in Acts chapter 8 as far as where he went. But it's very possible that some didn't want to, you know, completely leave that general area. So they just bumped things up a little bit. Saul certainly would have had plenty of people to persecute in Jerusalem. And I think that's why you see in Acts 9, he's taking those letters of authority to go to Damascus. Because
that's why I was wondering if maybe, you know, it says the churches throughout Judea, Galilee, and Samaria, maybe they were established by some of these people that left Jerusalem whenever he was persecuting in Jerusalem.
Yeah. It's possible. And you don't know. You might have people who have fled to two or three different locations. And maybe they, you know, for whatever reason, were able to get a congregation established here. Let's say that 50 people are there and 40 end up heading somewhere else and you've still got a small congregation. But it's at least interesting to entertain those ideas because it is a real possibility.
When I read in Revelation about the seven churches out of Asia, even though some of those were pretty bad, you don't ever read, at least I don't ever read, where God told the good people to leave. They were to stay there and work through that.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, it's a natural part of life that you're going to have the good with the bad, and you just got to, you know, make sure that you have steeled yourself, braced yourself, and you're going to do your best to work through those times. Stan, and then Tim.
Whenever there's a rough time comes, sometimes it has to be a shock, sometimes it can be a little bit more long term. But I remember when the World Trade Center was. However you want to describe it. But there were a lot of people at that point in time, it only happened for a short period of time, but returned to churches and prayer and so on and so forth. I'm kind of wondering whether some of this might have been because Christianity offered relief to those who were under Roman persecution as well as persecution from the Jews.
Yeah, people were looking for hope. And oftentimes some form of religion, not necessarily a true form, but some form of religion is the way that they think that they can find help. And there is help there. You just need to make sure that you find what is true and what's right. Otherwise, like I say, you can still find some mental relief, but ultimately that's not going to help you in the hereafter. I want to give you some information. This came across my desk a few days ago. It's some information about the Jehovah's Witnesses in Russia. The names, I would just completely butcher them, so I'm going to change them to Alex and Victoria. Russia's, well, that's just, all right. Russia's Supreme Court ordered the dissolution of Jehovah's Witnesses in Russia. This was back in April of this year. With masks and rifles, police came to Alex's door in the early morning and made him pack a bag. He was wanted for religious extremism as a Jehovah's Witness. Now remember, the Witnesses, they're pacifists. They're not people out there that are trying to act like some Islamic extremists. Forget it, they told his wife, Victoria, taking away the couple's tablet devices, computers, and phones. Go and find a new phone, a new tablet, and a new husband. Alex, who lives in the industrial city of Ufa, was more than one of 20 members of the U.S.-founded, quote-unquote, Christian movement detained across Russia in recent months. They risk up to 10 years in jail, according to Human Rights Watch. Various groups have been targeted under a 2016 anti-extremism law. An additional 2017 Supreme Court ruling targeted the Witnesses specifically, ordering their dissolution in Russia. Officially, it's a totalitarian sect of extremists. But in fact, these are people who, because of their faith, are not susceptible to propaganda, said a man identified as a Russian FSB secret office by Radio Liberty. The system sees them as a threat because they are organized and independent. Now think about that. They are independent. There's no central headquarters, which isn't quite right, but anyway, they are independent in some respects. One day they may seek power, he told the station in an interview earlier this year. The Witnesses told the AFP that 22 of their members were in jail in Russia, including a couple detained together on July 4th. Human Rights Watch said police threatened the Witnesses in raids, in some cases holding guns to people's heads. We don't see any reasonable explanation for it, said John. Again, that's my name for him, a senior JW representative in Russia. But we do not forget the words of Christ. Just as I've been persecuted, so you will be persecuted. Alex, age 35, said investigators classed their Bible readings and prayer groups as extremist activity. It's humiliating. It's unjust. We're peaceful citizens, far from any kind of extremism. But they consider us criminals. I talk to people as the Constitution permits. I share with them what I've gained from the Bible as I think it can help them. They are close to the people. They preach and promote their religion openly, so that makes for competition and rivalry with the Russian Orthodox Church. And that's where the problem is. It's not that they think that they're really dangerous to the state, but it's interfering with the state church. A senior Russian bishop, Hiram, again, that's my name for him, said Jehovah's Witnesses destroy people's minds and destroy families. But he insisted the prosecutions were a judicial matter, not a religious one. The church generally does not call for the prosecution of heretics, sectarians, or dissidents, he told the television station in Russia. Such a decision is made by the state, not on the basis of any doctrinal guidelines, but because a sect is engaged in extremist activities. The witnesses say about 200 of the members have fled from Russia to Finland and thousands more to other countries. Alex was held for 9 days in April and then transferred to house arrest pending trial. He's not allowed to talk to journalists. His wife, Victoria, said they are appealing his case at the Supreme Court and European Court of Human Rights. I will not renounce my faith. It is my life, my principle, she said. I cannot live any other way. So we can look at Acts 9 and say, well, that was really bad. That was really unfortunate. It must have been tough cookies for those people. And it was. But I'm telling you, that same kind of stuff is taking place in our world today. Now, you might say, well, that's the witnesses, and they're considered a cult, and all those other things I know. But Russia has also given our brethren some difficulties over the years. And bear in mind that when you look at history and you look at time, it's very possible that the United States is one day going to be in that same boat. And you need to decide right now, if we live long enough, what side you're going to be on. We'll all have to make that decision. Are we going to go through those good times and those bad times, or are we going to be that kind of fair weather saint that says, well, as long as all things are okay, and you know, we've got a nice congregation and we're not being persecuted and everything else is okay, we're on board. But when those hard times come, we're done, we quit. It's not worth it. But yeah, that's a choice that each one of us may make. Quick other point, and then we'll see if there's anything that you want to add or ask. The fear of the Lord. That reminds us a little bit of Acts chapter 5, verses 5 and 11. There was also that respect for God. Points back, I think, to recognizing God's authority in religious matters. You don't fear God, what are you going to do when it comes to his word? Respect it, follow it, or not? God's just like the old man in the rocking chair. We don't have any fear of him. We don't have any respect for him. So we're going to do what we want when it comes to religion. We're going to change things around. We'll follow this, but not this, or we will revise that. The comfort of the Holy Spirit. Some people get some really weird ideas about that. I don't know that that's all that difficult. When you think about people becoming, again, you have a reference here to people who'd been from a Jewish background, the Jews in Judea, Samaria, Galilee. When you have people coming from that kind of background, what kind of system was the Old Testament? Easy or hard? It was like a yoke. It was like great bondage. And here these Christians are now learning there's a new system. Christ, and you can become a Christian. And what about the 600 plus laws that are in the Old Testament system? Taken away. You've got a new system. And here's all, you don't have to have any bulls and goats, and you don't have to have a special priest, and you don't have to have all these other things. And as the Spirit was revealing that information, that surely gave great comfort to God's people. They must have come to understand how again and again they were living under a better covenant. So you have, as we said, what seems to be a united congregation locally and in the areas that we've talked about, and just a great, great time to have been a Christian, especially now that Saul's persecution had ended. Anything that you want to add or ask with the last 6 minutes that we've got? Okay, we've got Acts chapter 9, 32 to 35. Let's go ahead and at least delve into at least some of this. 32 says, and it came to pass as Peter went throughout all parts, he came down also to the saints that dwelt at Lydda. And there he found a certain man named Annas, who had kept his bed 8 years, for he was palsied. And Peter said unto him, Annas, Jesus Christ healeth thee, rise and take thy bed, or make thy bed. And straightway or immediately he arose. And all that dwelt at Lydda and Sharon saw him, and they turned to the Lord. Who's been the focus, at least the last several verses? Acts 9. Paul. All right. Sometimes you say, you've had enough attention, now we're going to turn to somebody else. That's sort of what Luke does here. So we leave Saul for a little bit, and now who do we turn to? The attention is now focused on Peter. We are going to get back to Saul/Paul, but that's going to occur a couple chapters later. It's going to be in Acts chapter 11 and verse 30. If you think ahead a little bit, do we have some more information about Peter in Acts 10 and Acts 11? Yeah, we do. Who's Peter going to go see? Fairly famous conversion. The household of Cornelius. And Luke devotes two chapters to that. But for now, Saul kind of moves to the back burner. You have Peter. It seems like he was working as an itinerant missionary down there in the area of Jerusalem, Judea, and now he's able to turn his attention elsewhere. Let's pause here and think about this lesson for a bit. If we need to go on, we will. But here's a great lesson. Here's Peter. He's spending a lot of time down there in the area of Jerusalem. Why do you think that Peter may have been so focused on Jerusalem for a period of time? Some other apostles there as well. What had been taking place in Jerusalem?
Persecution.
Persecution. Do you think the apostles had to kind of stay there and see if they could kind of put some fires out with persecution? What were we just talking about? When times get bad? All right. And you need some people that will hopefully sit down with some folks and help them understand the consequences of that. If you're going to have somebody sit down and help explain that to some folks, who do you think the logical choice is going to be? Not some new Christian. It's going to be somebody like an apostle. But now, if you've sort of put those fires out because Saul is no longer ratcheting up the persecution, what are you now free to do? You now, because you're not needed in that special sense or that important way, you now can go into other areas. Let's look at it in terms of kids. And then we'll come back to the religious realm. You have young children. And there are some things that you might need to do. You need to go out and, you know, maybe work on a car or work in the yard or clean the house. But why can't you do those things? You've now got to spend that time caring for that young child. But when that child gets old enough to care for himself or herself, now what can you do? You can now divert your attention to some other things. What's the application of that when it comes to the spiritual realm? If you've got a congregation where you're always having to tend fires and, you know, there's always just internal conflict and strife and there's this, that, and the other thing that ties people down, where's your attention got to be always focused? Right there. And if your attention always, and I'm not saying ignore that, but if the attention always has to be focused here internally, then what's that do to you externally? Your hands are always tied up. You have almost no time, energy, and resources. So you get that picture in the New Testament when it comes to saints. Do you want just people who've been baptized? No. Do you want people who are just pew warmers? No. Do you want people who are immature Christians? No. You want some people who can learn to, in some respects, be self-sufficient so that they can go out and do some good. And the other people who probably would be needing to tend to those things in the congregation can also go and take care of some other matters. So immaturity has some severe consequences for a lot of people in a local congregation. Anything that you want to add or ask on that point? Okay. Let's take a look at 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 13, and then I think we're going to wrap it up here. First Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 13. Who's got it and wants to read it? 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 13. All right, Bonnie, I saw you first.
And esteem them very highly in love for the word's sake, and be at peace among yourselves.
All right, those final few words. Be at what?
Peace.
Be at peace. And who is to be at peace?
All
right, the local congregation. Good words, important words for a lot of reasons. Number one, you're going to hopefully have a place that you are more inclined to be a part of. But two, you're going to, as we mentioned a few minutes ago, be in a position where you can do a better job as far as reaching out, and other people are going to also be in a better position to do some things externally rather than always fighting fires. The other aspect of that is this. Do you think Peter and the other apostles would have gotten tired trying to fight fires internally? That gets discouraging. And you find that, I think, sometimes when you look at businesses. If they're always having, and that's not really their primary job. Well, let's look at maybe a better perspective as a teacher. I heard, and I mentioned this, maybe a few months ago, as far as a public school teacher. He was in a Bible class, and he said, I want to teach. I mean, kids come to my classroom, I want to teach. But he said, I'm having to spend my time each day not teaching. He said, I'm having to go back and talk about manners and don't beat Johnny up and those kinds of things. And he said, I'm having to police the kids. He said, that's 70 or 80% of my day. I can't do my job. I can't do the other things that need to be done because I'm having to do what parents should have done. That was frustrating to him. That burns teachers out. And that's also true in other realms. Once again, anything that you want to add or ask before we shut it down?
Well,